This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Well, we go this afternoon on Memorial Day weekend 2013 from the jazz music tenor sax of John Ellis in New York to a program about music. We have with us today in the studio two composers, both of whom received their doctorate in musical arts here at the University of Illinois, Shirley Meyer Blankenship, who is, among other things, a harpist. She plays the harp. And Mark Enslin, who's a composer as well as an organizer for the School for Designing a Society. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good to have you here. And Mark, tell us, Shirley, I know, plays the harp in the Champaign-Urbana Symphony and other groups in this area. Are you a performer of music, or you specialize in composing?
I did study composing, and also I perform. I studied bassoon when I was in the university, got my minor in bassoon. So I've played bassoon and contrabassoon in different groups and sometimes orchestras. But then I wanted to learn every instrument that I could get my hands on. And for the past 4 years, I've been studying tablas with Subrata Bhattacharya, who sometimes is in Urbana. So
now
I explore instruments.
Now tell me what that instrument is. I'm not familiar with it.
It is the traditional drums of Hindustani music. It's a pair of small drums, and you sit down and play. One of them is a large bowl, and one is a smaller kind of wooden. And one has a kind of a ping sound, and the other is a boom sound.
Huh.
And I've always been curious about that musical style, and then this teacher, master, came into town, and I thought, well, I'll just find out about it, and I sort of got hooked with that. So, and also, Shirley's a multi-instrumentalist, too. She's a virtuoso on
violin and viola, I know.
Well, since he brought up some more esoteric instruments, one of the instruments that I studied for a while was the veena. Most people know what a sitar is. A veena is very similar. Another instrument that I worked on for a while was called the goosely, and it's a Russian instrument. I didn't stay with that instrument because I didn't want to become known as a gooselyist.
Since you're primarily known as a harpist, I've been thinking all this week about talking with a harpist, and I never have before, either on the air or anywhere else. So it's just a treat for me. It's such a how to talk about it. For one thing, it's huge and it's heavy, and it rolls around on wheels. And you're not a large woman. Have you had trouble wrestling that into vehicles and out of vehicles and into venues and you get help? How do you do that?
Well, I have not had trouble because I do get help, and I owe a lot of thanks to many people in this community who at one time or the other have loaded and unloaded my harp. I think there was a time that I did that myself. Maybe it's in my imagination, because at this point I just can't fathom that I could do that.
How much does a harp weigh?
I would say maybe about 80 pounds. It's not that it's so heavy. It's that it's bulky and it's very awkward, and the weight distribution is strange.
And it's delicate, right? If it falls over, it's a huge expense to repair.
Don't want that to happen when you've spent like $17,000 on an instrument, and the instrument of my dreams would cost $82,000. So
wow.
Probably wouldn't even want to breathe on that instrument.
So this is one of the more expensive instruments in the orchestra.
With the exception maybe of pianos.
Uh-huh, sure.
Right, I would say so.
Right. And I was thinking also about the harp. In a recent concert, I was singing with a choir, the Bach choir locally, and I was standing, it happened, behind the organist where his keyboard was. And I was noticing that the violins were able to look at their music and look up at the director very frequently because they only have one note they're playing at a time, usually, and occasionally two, but usually just one note at a time, or most of the bassoon would be playing just one note at a time. But the organist, and I know from looking at your music that you've written, that you've composed, the harpist has to look at a whole lot of notes at the same time, chords, and you're playing with, it looks like, 10 fingers at once, like sometimes pianists have to do, an organist. And as a result, how do you look at all those notes on a score and look at the conductor?
Very perceptive question.
You didn't mention feet either.
That's right. You have pedals.
You have pedals to navigate. It is one of the most difficult things to get across to people what the complications are of playing harp in an orchestra, because it's not just a matter of having all those notes to play. The big difference between playing a keyboard and the harp is the visual aspect, because you have to see all of those strings. That's why they're color-coded. On a keyboard, you can navigate by feel, and that's why there are a good number of blind keyboard players. I have never, ever heard of a blind harpist, because the spacing between the strings is all the same, and you don't have any black keys in between to help guide you.
And they feel the same, pretty much.
They feel the same. The spacing is the same.
Okay.
The only difference in feel, basically, is that the strings at the top are thinner, and as you go down, they're thicker, so that can help you at least
sort of. But that's very gradual.
Right.
And how many strings are on a harp?
About 47.
47.
And that also brings up an interesting phenomenon, and that is when playing a piece, let's say, written by Wagner, who liked to put in for the harp measures where you would play 7 notes on one beat and 8 beats on another beat and 4 on another beat and 6 on another, so that you're constantly changing the number of notes per beat during some sort of romantic type of passage, so that the conductor sort of goes crazy with his baton and the harpist is going crazy because they have to be watching the strings like crazy and at the same time see the conductor. So it is sometimes an awesome situation.
Very difficult. Now, I want to get to, we're going to hear some harp music that you've composed, but not right quite yet. But you compose music from what I've looked at. And I've never heard it yet because, maybe on your website I could hear one of your pieces?
On the WW website?
Yes.
No, on that website.
Not there. Okay. Well, I can't remember. At any rate, you write contemporary music. You're a composer of the 20th, 21st century. This may be harp music that people aren't used to hearing.
Yes, and what I have found to be the case is that some people who seem to have an aversion to contemporary music will end up liking the contemporary music for the harp, and I think that's just because of the sound of the harp.
Ah.
It's hard not to like what you're hearing.
Angelic? No, we wouldn't say that. We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with two composers and performers of music. Shirley Meyer Blankenship is the harpist, and Mark Enslin is a bassoonist and performs on drums and other instruments, as well as being a composer. Both have doctorates from the University of Illinois in composition in the School of Music. Shirley, you were the first woman to get that degree. Can I ask you what year that was?
I think my degree was finally awarded about 1977, 75, 77, somewhere in there. And I want to say that I did not set out to be a pioneer. I actually did not know that I was the first woman to get that degree till the day it was granted to me and somebody mentioned to me that I was the first woman. Hmm. Had I recognized the honor, and had I recognized the possibilities there, I probably would have dropped almost everything else and simply gone the whole route with composition.
So you were studying harp as well at the same time?
No.
No. You were playing the harp.
The interesting part is I don't have a degree in the harp.
Oh, you don't?
No. Everything else, but not the harp.
Okay. Were you playing violin and viola then?
Yes.
Okay.
But I started off as a pianist, and that's what I got a scholarship to the university doing, was playing the piano.
I see.
I just happened to play the harp, and people kept calling on me to perform, so I end up being the harp professor at the university, which is sort of an amazing thing.
And if you wanted to get paid, you played what people were willing to pay to hear.
I guess so.
One thing that interests me about that beginning sentence, or about yourself as the first woman to get that degree at the University of Illinois, is as a composer, I would hear a fact like that. It's a fact, and people give kind of political significance to that. But I, in addition to that, just ask the question, how is it that we live in a society where that can be true? At that late date in history, that could be a first.
Yeah.
And then to go on and answer that question could be a compositional project and not really a historical or factual fact-finding project, but a compositional project. How to describe what we want and what we are in the medium of music or whatever medium we choose that would help people actually get a sense of that beyond just the facts of it.
So are you suggesting a musical composition that would express frustration with that fact in our society?
It could be frustration, could be marveling, it could be kind of the questioning mode, like it's an emotion of questioning, astonishment possibly.
After having come through the Romantic period in music and art and literature and so on, it's often hard for modern people to think of music expressing emotions like anger.
Well, that's...
Well, I'd say that as long as a human being is writing the music, whether one is expressing anger directly or indirectly, I think it's hard not for it to be there. I definitely hear it in my music. I hear rage. I hear screaming. And it's not that I was setting out necessarily to depict any particular emotional condition. I wrote a piece called Entanglement. And it gets pretty entangled and intense. And if one wants to equate intensity with anger, and there's certainly a relationship there,
sure,
that's going to come out through the music some way.
Mozart's 40th Symphony has a pretty nice tantrum in it, which I've been inspired by. So.
We're talking with our two composers on Keeping the Faith, but we're also eager to talk with listeners. You may call us. This is a live program on this Memorial Day weekend, Sunday the 26th of May in the year 2013. I say that because many people will listen to this on podcasts and wonder perhaps what day it is it was recorded. But our listeners may participate by calling 333-9455 in the 217 area code. If it's long distance, punch in 1-800-222-9455 for our toll-free number. So locally, 333-WILL, long distance, 800-222-WILL. Well, Shirley, we've talked about some of your music. Let's go to an example. Tell us about the metaphysical waltz that we're going to hear.
I would describe this as an avant-garde music piece.
Up-to-date, modern, contemporary.
Whatever. I find putting labels on things enormously difficult.
Sure.
But if I have to say put a label on it, then I would say that. It uses things like tapping on the sounding board.
Of the harp?
Yes.
And you're performing this piece?
Yes.
So you wrote it, you're performing it. But it includes not just the strings, but the rest
of the
instrument.
Correct, but the sounding board and use of pedals to make glisses, the use of pedal changes while a person is doing the famous harp glissando type of thing, so that the pitches are fluctuating at the time that they're done. I must say that my experience has been that every harpist that's looked at this piece has found it very formidable, and so far I don't have any other people that have performed it.
So it's difficult to play.
It is, but it's very idiomatic. And I finally came across a harpist who took the time to look at the score, and she concluded that it's very idiomatic.
What does that mean?
That means it falls well into the hands. And one of the things that scares performers is that it's full of accidentals.
Ah.
But see, I knew how to set up the pedals in such a way that those accidentals aren't requiring enormous amounts of pedal changes all at once.
So harpists who look at the score might be initially thinking it would be very difficult, but as they played it, they discover it's easier than it seems.
Very much so. It lies well in the hands. Things are easy to do, except maybe the last page. And the last page is very difficult because it does so many different things in rapid succession, like hitting the soundboard, pedal slides, chords.
Now, do you make any vocal sounds like Thelonious Monk did when he was playing jazz on the piano?
Well, I might have, but but they didn't come into the recording.
Well, let's listen now to Shirley Blankenship playing a composition that she wrote for the harp, Metaphysical Waltz.
Oh, that's Nick. Peace. I came up to hurry.
Well, we came to the end of the Metaphysical Waltz, and we heard a little bit of another piece of Shirley's. But tell us about Metaphysical Waltz. Why the title?
When you look at it, at the score carefully, you will notice that it's in 3/4 time, and waltzes are in threes, and that there are all sorts of subdivisions of threes. And I like to think of it as a sort of dance. So it seemed appropriate to say Metaphysical Waltz. And I say metaphysical because it isn't like the waltz that most people recognize.
And have you studied philosophy and know about the divisions of ways of thinking and thinking about different things like metaphysics?
Well, I wouldn't say studied.
Okay.
I would say some awareness.
All right. Let's go to a caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guests, our two composers today, Mark Enslin and Shirley Meyer Blankenship. Go ahead.
Yes. My question is, how does one exactly go about learning how to play the harp? And I'll listen to your answer offline.
Thanks for the call.
Very carefully. What I recommend to beginner players is to get a small troubadour harp that does not have the pedals that go with the concert harp. Because the first thing is to master finger techniques. And I shouldn't say probably master, but to start to deal with the issues of how to handle the hands.
How much would a smaller troubadour harp cost? Used.
I have looked into this recently, and I have been astounded because it used to be possible to get a nice little troubadour folk harp type thing for about $500. And now, recently I've been seeing prices like $1,000, $2,000, $5,000. But one of the reasons I recommend the troubadour harp is the expense of the instrument.
Sure.
And so many people want to do something, and then they discovered it's more difficult than they thought, and so they give it up. Well, you don't want to urge people to put in, let's say, several thousand dollars on an instrument that is going to go by the wayside.
Right.
But that's the place to start.
Now, do you teach harp? Do you teach private lessons?
I do once in a while. I teach over at the Unit 1 program, University of Illinois, and primarily I'm teaching violin, viola, and cello over there.
Okay.
Occasionally I will get a beginning harp student. In fact, to the webmaster that created my website, the Harp Legacy Project, was one of my harp students, and she did use a little troubadour harp to start.
Well, we need to talk about the Harp Legacy Project, but before we do, we also need to talk a little bit about what's coming up tomorrow on Focus on Memorial Day. Let's hear what that news is.
Earlier this year, the Obama administration expanded the military positions open to women, including those in ground combat units. On Monday's Focus, we present an encore broadcast looking at women in combat. We'll also explore what life is like for military women and men after their service ends and their civilian life begins. That's an encore edition of Focus, Monday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580.
Encore sounds so much better than archive, don't you think? Play it again. Play it again, Sam. Musicians, of course, are often asked to play something they become known for over and over again until they get kind of tired of it. Has that happened to you, Mark?
People mostly have not heard of what I do, but there are some pieces that I rely on and have performed on lots. One of them is a piece called Sonata Quijada for a table of toys, including Jack in the Box. And then at the end, there's a text from the church committee hearings about the CIA. And suddenly you think, wait, what are those toys meant? And so this piece I've done over and over again.
That was Senator Church.
Yeah, yep, right. In the 70s. So it was it's sort of a theatrical, political, and also satirical music piece it's just works well enough to illustrate compositional issues or to make a political statement, or it's portable. And so I found that partially because of the features of what I wrote, it keeps coming up. And I think maybe that happens a little bit with the Metaphysical Waltz also. It just has so much in it, this short little piece. It's sort of built to survive.
Uh-huh. People want to hear it again and see what they missed and see how it all fits together.
Yeah, or uh-huh. At least that it's short enough that they wouldn't mind. They could tolerate being in its presence again.
Mark, you said that you include theater in some of your musical pieces. Tell us more about that.
When I was studying composition here, I found people who were emphasizing the composition more than the music. So it was what is composing? Making something that no one else would make, putting things together that no one else would put together or hasn't been put together in this way before. And then maybe you can choose a medium, an orchestra, chamber group, or solo, objects,
a solo instrument,
voices, sure. speech, and people that I was working with got really curious about all kinds of sounds. The whole realm of sound opened up in the last 100 years, and so this notion of not taking for granted what the medium is something that I then thought, well, if I have an idea that seems to have a visual possibility, and people of this age are not necessarily sure how to respond to sounds, but maybe visuals more, I'll put both in just to make sure. And so it's something that I hope can be listened to on a recording, but could also be seen, and the seeing would add something.
Now, when we began the show, I introduced you both as composers, but I also mentioned that Shirley Meyer Blankenship plays the harp in the Champaign-Urbana Symphony and other organizations. She teaches other musical organizations. She teaches violin, viola, piano too.
Yes.
Yes. So, and Mark, I mentioned that you are a organizer for the School for Designing a Society. I take it that's a paid position?
Sometimes there is some little bit of compensation that comes from it. But it's really a project that was started by other, mostly composers, but not exclusively, where it was an attempt to try to create a school as if it was a composition. And so instead of taking school as something for granted, I get a degree and then I go teach somewhere in a place that's already set up, trying to figure out, well, if I was going to make a school from scratch, kind of like Dr. Seuss's book, If I Ran the Zoo, what would be in it and who would come to it and how would I be in it and how would we be together in it? And so over the past more than 20 years, we've been trying out these experiments, and it's an experimental school, so I guess what I'd call it.
And how many other composers were involved with starting it or are involved with it still?
When we started, like the first session that we had, it was a summer session in West Virginia. There were 11 teacher organizers and 11 students. So it was 1-to-1 faculty ratio. And nowadays we're going to be having another summer program and there will be 5 main teachers and about 20 students.
And the students pay to take these courses?
Yeah.
How much?
It is $1,200 for 3 weeks.
And that's not enough for the teachers to live on.
No, it's not. It's a project to create something more than it was trying to make a living. And so to supplement that, I proofread and do other performances, trying to compose a career as well as school.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. That's a very interesting topic these days. We've just had graduation at the University of Illinois. Other people just got their DMAs, their Doctor of Musical Arts, some in composition. Some of those musicians will be fortunate enough to find a paying position playing somewhere in an orchestra or band, or maybe they'll start their own performance group and sell MP3s that people will pay $1.95 to download onto their various instruments in their pockets. But a lot of musicians, a lot of people in the other liberal arts and humanities have trouble getting paid for what they just got a degree in. Are you sad? Are you disappointed that someone didn't pay you all your life to just compose music?
Shirley.
who's first?
I wouldn't say I'm disappointed. I have pretty much lived at the poverty level for, 20 or 30 years. I've had a warm house to be in, and I've been able to eat, and basically I've been able to engage in activities that mean something to me. So.
And your late husband was also a musician.
Yes, and he made less money than I did because he was a jazz saxophone player. Part of his living was made sweeping floors, but he was a wonderful performer. So it's a problem because my mind just doesn't work like turning music into a business. And that's reflected in my harp legacy project. And I can tell you that recently I received the score. There was 48 pages long. It was for harp and cello. And I probably spent easily 100 hours editing that score. No complaint whatsoever. But I can tell you that I got paid $200. So you probably can do that math. I really don't care as long as I have a means, some sort of way of surviving. I would do that work for nothing because I see the need for harpists to be working with composers in order to come up with some scores that are viable for harpists. And why I started the project is I had encountered so many scores with so many issues, and then I couldn't talk to the composers because many of them were no longer with us, and I couldn't dig them up and have a conversation. So,
what did you mean by this in the notation? What did you mean by this in this part of the score?
Right, or here's the problem you have created, and if we could just discuss it and we could rearrange a few notes, this problem would be gone, and you would save your harpist a lot of consternation.
Sure, so, because a lot of the people who write for an orchestra or a small chamber group that includes a harp may never have played the instrument much. Now, maybe they were introduced to it
Absolutely.
A little bit, but how can you learn 100 different instruments in an orchestra, or these days 1,000, because we're talking about world music?
I was just talking to Mark in the parking lot about it. It's a piece that most people are familiar with. The harp cadenza in the Nutcracker Suite.
Sure.
Certain things that people don't think about, but when you get up there to play that piece, you do it after many measures of sitting there at rest, and the first thing you have to do is run all over the harp. People never think about things like that.
So there's no warm-up for
there's
you.
There's no warm-up.
Well, along those lines, the way I think about that question is, in general, our society doesn't really appreciate work very well. Work is sort of hidden. The people who do work are considered greedy somehow, and yet those who exploit their work are not. So it's kind of like a really sore point in our society. And when I think about my own work as composer, it's mixed in with play and with something that I would do whether I was paid or not, but also in solidarity with people who are doing work and artists who are conscious of how much effort they put into what they're making. I try to honor that as well. And so it's a really tricky sort of sore point. And I wish that people listening would see themselves as in solidarity in some way. Like when I go to a concert, here's a fellow worker who has been working in music, and we help each other out in some way.
When musicians do get paid, they're often just paid for a very short performance. Maybe they're paid for one rehearsal of that piece, but to get to the place where they can play it well, they've had to practice all their lives.
Amen. Not only that, this brings up an issue close to my heart, and that is I've done many scores for local theater. So what does that involve? Frequently the scores are 250 pages or more. Before I ever came to the first rehearsal, it could be that I spent 100 hours on the score, an hour per page. The other thing is those scores are called orchestral reductions. So I have to tell you, they really are piano expansions because somebody comes along and takes all the notes out of the orchestra score and puts them in the piano score, makes it unplayable. So therefore, you have to do an arrangement of it before you can even play it. Then you have to remember it unless you want to write it all out by hand. So this is all done before the rehearsal, and I was always very fastidious about coming prepared to the first rehearsal.
Sure.
Then there are 8 weeks of rehearsal, about 6 nights a week, 3 hours a night. Plus, you might have to make a recording for the choreographer who wants to spend extra time outside of the rehearsal
of the dance part of it,
et cetera, et cetera. And the pay for it is $350 for 8 weeks of that, and that's not including the gigs that you give up because you've already committed to doing the show, and it's not including the car expenses going over there. So I used to refer to this as my 5-cent-an-hour job.
But what pleasures do you get from it? Why do you do it?
I wouldn't, if I weren't getting pleasures from it, I would not do that.
What are those pleasures for a musician, for someone who's given their life to this?
one of the pleasures that I get, and this is regardless of whatever style of music I'm playing, it could, yeah. whether it's contemporary or whether it is jazz or whatever it is trying to do a really expert job. So my pleasure was putting those scores together to the point that I was so comfortable with them that I could play them anytime, any place, anywhere. There's a
so
power.
achieving excellence is
right.
Is,
there's a transcendence to me of the human condition of trying to excel to the highest degree that you can. It's a transcendent experience, and then it's the working together, bringing all those parts together to create whatever it is you're going to create. Again, without putting any value on what that is. That it comes together and that you're presenting this to a public that gets some sort of pleasure, whether this is a comedy, whatever it is that you're putting out there. It's sharing. So there's all of that. And I'm not really complaining about the money aspect of it. It's a painful thing. It's just that we all need to eat, too. So
sure.
That's...
What about applause, Mark? When you perform one of the pieces you've composed and you've performed it, and it includes theater and it includes all these interesting instruments. If the audience responds warmly with applause and bravos, does that compensate in any way, at least emotionally, for the time and effort you put in that you haven't been paid adequately for?
Well, certainly it's wonderful. And I see that as a sign that people are not thinking in terms of compensation, which is fine with me.
Uh-huh.
And it's more like there is something going on communally. We're celebrating a moment of discovering something together, and everybody wants to make some kind of sound to mark that moment. And also I was thinking in relation to this that the story you were telling earlier, Shirley, about the mechanic where...
Yes.
That was off air, so do repeat that story.
Oh, just that I had noticed that he seemed to be a little bit depressed.
This is your auto mechanic.
This is my auto mechanic. He has a little place that he works out of, and I happen to have an affinity for veterans from Vietnam or Korea, and he's one of those people. And he's a wonderful little mechanic because he doesn't overcharge. For example, if you need brake work done, he will do things like just clean the rust off the brake. Your brake might last another 2 years as a result of what he does without his replacing them all. But at any rate, so I took him a little recording of a group, one of my harp clients sent me, and it was a group of music from a 30s, 40s, and it was an ensemble with strings and guitar and harp. And he puts that on, and he said, the last time I was in there, he was smiling and happy and saying that it just made a huge difference when he was working on cars to be listening to it.
So the change of state of mind,
sure.
some kind of
sure.
altered positive
yes.
direction.
Surely called just, it transcendent sometimes. Would you go that far?
Yeah.
Okay.
People have told me, when you even just described this thing you were working on, that idea sort of stayed with me, and it made me think something else was possible.
Huh.
And so someone else might try something that they wouldn't otherwise try because of some of these experiments that Shirley and I are doing.
Mark wrote a piece that's very interesting to me for a lot of reasons, which I may not have time to get into all of them. But it's a piano piece that he wrote. And a local performer by the name of Susan Parenti performed it. When I saw the piece or heard it, and it is to be seen and heard, I think it was about 40 minutes. I've heard that it's kind of faster now, but at any rate, it's an exceedingly difficult piece to play. I can recognize
for piano.
That. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But she not only has to play that part, she has to talk. The whole time. Enormously difficult prospects. And she said it took her 4 years to learn the piece.
Wow.
admire that.
Yeah.
I admire expertise. And
was it videotaped, I hope?
It was videotaped, and we're working to get a professional recording at Pogo so it'll be kind of like a radio play, so you get some of the visuals through the audio.
And I was asking you earlier off the air, Mark, where people could go to hear some of your music, and you said at spinelessbook.com.
Spineless Books.
Books. BOOKS.com/your last name, which is Enslin, E-N-S-L-I-N. SpinelessBooks.com/Enslis. So they can hear or purchase, hear samples perhaps, or at least purchase.
Here, there are some scores there also.
Okay.
And also there is archive.org/details. And then if you search for my name, there's four different recordings that you can hear there.
Okay. Repeat that, please.
archive.org/details.
D-E-T-A-I-L-S, then slash your name?
I think if you search for the name.
Search then, for yeah. Enslin, E-N-S-L-I-N.
There's a recording of that piano voice piece that was just talking about,
right.
And a few others.
Was that played by Susan Prenti on that recording?
Yes, it was.
All right. And we might tell listeners where you can find information about one of Shirley's legacies projects. She has two going on right now. One is just called Shirley's Legacy, and you can find out about that where, Shirley?
It's a fundraising project on Indiegogo.
I-N-D-I-E-G-O-G-O. And then look.
And I find that if you can get into the site and you go to the browse section.
So that's Indiegogo.com.
Yes.
And then you browse for.
There are different categories, and one of them is called creative. And if you go into creative, there's music.
And then go to Shirley Meyer Blankenship.
Well, just Shirley's Legacy.
Shirley's Legacy,
yes.
Okay. And tell us about the Harp Legacy Project.
The Harp Legacy Project came into existence after. Working with numerous scores that had problems in them, including, as I mentioned, the Waltz of the Flowers that people hear frequently. That piece is not playable as written, so it requires that harpists have to do a lot of rewriting. So after years of encountering big-time issues and not being able to discuss them with composers, I instigated the the Harp Legacy Project, offering my services as a consultant and editor for composers that have either written for or are writing or wish to write music for the harp. There have been numerous manuals written to help composers. Among them is, I think most famous, is by Carlos Salcedo, who was a virtuoso harpist and an innovative composer in his own right. But what I discovered is that these manuals just don't do the trick. I spent one entire semester teaching harp composition at the university. I have in front of me here a pile of compositions from that class. And what I can tell you, I could spend another semester with each one of those composers on their particular pieces with the aim of getting the piece to be written in a way that a harpist can manage it.
Can actually play it.
Can actually play it with notation that speaks to the harpist. So that's why I started this particular kind of project. I'm not the only one required in this. I can see in the future that harpists and composers need to do a lot of getting together, writing in collaboration, because there are just too many issues that crop up, particularly in symphonic works where you might have three rehearsals and you have to perform something and you run into these impossible things to do. So, but across the board, I would love to see a growing number of people collaborate.
I want to get back to talking about collaboration among composers and musicians and others, but we're about 15 minutes from the close of our Keeping the Faith program today. Let me reintroduce our guests. We're talking with Shirley Meyer Blankenship, Dr. Blankenship, who has taught music at the University of Illinois and teaches independently. Her DMA, Doctor of Musical Arts degree, came from the University of Illinois in 1977 or so, and where she was the first female to receive that degree here at this university, after the university had been here over 100 years, finally. And we're also talking with Mark Enslin, E-N-S-L-I-N, another composer and a bassoon player and player of other instruments, world music instruments, and who is an organizer for the School for Designing a Society, which will be offering classes for composers this summer here at the University of Illinois.
Not at the university.
It's not at the university.
No.
It's at this independent school at the Independent Media Center, right?
And this summer the programs will be in West Virginia, but we do offer
things. Oh, I see. So this is a national program.
I guess you'd call it that. Wandering program.
Okay. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, but let me quickly say how grateful I am for the last 2 weeks of having two guest hosts, Don Nolan and Stan Yanchis. Don interviewed Michael Ledoux with his Poetic Impressions of Illinois on May 12, and Stan Yanchis interviewed two local priests about the local impact of the new Pope Francis for the Catholic Church on May 19th. I was otherwise occupied those nights and couldn't be here, and thank them so much for filling in so ably. I've been able to hear one of those programs and hope to hear the other one in the WILL archives. Let me remind listeners, you can do that by going to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith, and you'll see past programs. You can just jump back a date or two and play it on your whatever electronic instrument you choose to use to hear those programs. Coming up next week here on Keeping the Faith, I'll be talking with Sam Banks, who is the executive director of the Champaign-Urbana Boys and Girls Club, located on Park Avenue, just off University in Champaign. Sam Banks is well known in this community. He was for many years the director of Cunningham Children's Home in this community. Well known and a wonderful, wonderfully compassionate human being. We'll be talking to him June 2nd here in 2013, Sam Banks. On June 9th, we'll be talking by phone in California with Deanne Schmucker, who is the author of a recent book on group medical appointments. Now, you might think that's kind of odd, going to a medical appointment for yourself with other people, but it may well be a coming thing, and we'll be talking with Deanne Schmucker about that on June 9th, a way to reform the way medicine is delivered and find ways to do it more efficiently and cost-effectively. And then June 16th, I'll be traveling, and Don Nolan will be substituting again as guest host, and he'll be interviewing Kate Morgan about immigrant issues that are so important in our news today. So those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. Let me give the phone numbers again if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment today to our two guest composers. 333-9455 in the 217 area code. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk a little bit about collaboration. Shirley, you mentioned that as something you're trying to encourage with the HARP Legacy Project. But you and Mark are collaborating on something. Let's talk about what's that project. Mark?
Well, it started off with an invitation from Shirley after that performance she was just describing of this extremely difficult piano and voice piece that Susan Parenti was performing. Shirley came up to me and said, let's do a collaboration. Let's work together on something. And I think at that time she was maybe even mentioned the HARP and the HARP Legacy Project and her really practical ideas for how to have composers learn to write idiomatically and thoughtfully, compassionately for the harp. And that sounded like a really intriguing idea. And so we've had a number of conversations that were all over the place in terms of what to talk about and how to go about this. So it's still, in a way, just formulating what the project will be. And you want to take from there?
One of the interesting aspects from my point of view of working with Mark is that I feel that we're in the same camp, but we're sort of different aspects of the compositional issues. I tend to still write music for particular instruments, and apparently he does too because he wrote something for the piano. But I would say that if you compared the things that he's written and the things that I've written, you would find an enormous difference in the types of materials used to compose and different mindset. So I thought it would be very interesting to see if we could write a piece that could somehow combine our different orientations. And at the same time, maybe I would bend a little bit more. I'm not quite sure what word to put on it.
Less traditional.
Some more extreme, extreme kind of position about composition. I just wrote a letter to someone about all these extreme positions that I've seen, but I'm not quite sure what other word to use here. From my point of view, some of the things that went on in composition when I was coming along as a composer were pretty extreme points of view, because there was like John Cage and Ben Johnston, who was writing microtonal type of things. My whole orientation, I was a virtuoso player on three instruments by the time I was 18. I just was not in touch or connected to this idea of completely going off into some other area or some other direction. So I just thought it could be an interesting exchange between us to see how he approaches things and what's on his mind.
Well, we look forward to seeing what the results might be.
Well, you never know.
We may have to have you back. Now tell us, Shirley, how did you start in music? You mentioned learning three instruments, piano, violin, viola, very well by the time you were 18.
I started when I was four.
With what instruments?
I started with the piano.
Yes.
I was pretty much a virtuoso player by the time I was seven or eight.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Quincy, Illinois. I studied with a Sister Mary Angela across the street from where I live, so it was very convenient. I took a lesson every day before school. She had a harp in her studio. She was not a harpist herself, but she taught all kinds of people harp. Quincy was a big arena for harp students. I studied because I already did the piano. Then the school system started a string program, and they wanted me to be in it, so I started the violin. I really didn't come into my own on the violin till I was about 17, but I used to give these recitals, harp, piano, violin, and voice. I was also a singer.
Now, Dan Perino was in Quincy. Was he involved in the school system music when you were there?
Absolutely. He was a band director at high school, and I attempted to play French horn in the band. French horn and I were not on friendly terms.
Okay.
So it partly because I had perfect pitch, and when they'd say play C, I would play C, and it'd always be wrong because French horn is a transposing instrument. But there were other things as well that came into that scene. Yes, but he was definitely part of that music program.
Quite a musical town, Quincy, Illinois.
It definitely was. We had a symphony.
Where did you go after Quincy?
I came to the University of Illinois. As an undergraduate.
Playing piano.
Yes, Smith Music Scholarship. I got a master's degree in piano from Washington University. I got in St. Louis. And another master's from University of Illinois in music theory, and then the doctorate here. So,
sterling institutions, great professors. Was it a joy?
I loved being a student. I would be a student forever.
Yeah.
Yes.
What about you, Mark? What's your musical background? Did you grow up in a musical family?
Sort of. My grandmother was a church organist and piano teacher.
What could be better?
Right. And she was also really down to earth, and she offered music lessons. And so I studied piano with her for a while, and then I quit. And then secretly, I would play the piano when no one was around. Someone would start to approach, and I'd sort of...
A true rebel.
Right. Sneak away from the piano, pretend I was doing something else. And then when I was in high school, somewhere I heard or read something that suggested, that actually quoted Edgar Varèse's statement, the present-day composer refuses to die. Oh. And that attitude of refusal and creating something sounded really fascinating and heroic to me. And so I went to the college that was next to my high school, Webster College, now it's Webster University, and took some composition classes there and then came to the University of Illinois. and met people like Herbert Bruhn and other people in the composition faculty here who were really encouraging for the students coming in to make what they want to make rather than fit into something that already existed.
We're down to our last couple of minutes. Shirley, I particularly wanted you to share the Nietzsche quote that you have on your website.
Well, I think it pretty much says the whole thing when it says, without music, life would be a mistake. And it's certainly true for me because I have been now involved in music activities or some kind of artistic activities for now over 70 years. It's a long time. I can't imagine that I could have existed any other way. And as far as a choice in life, I don't see that I ever had one because I had perfect pitch and teachers came along and they were interested and I got support and encouragement and it just seemed to be my path.
So it's almost a calling?
I would say so, and a dedication and a mission. Yeah. My legacy, the Harp Legacy Project is definitely a mission.
A mission. Definitely. To make harp music more playable. Yeah.
More perceivable, and maybe some new twists on, maybe some new ways of composing things, but an examination of what can be done with the harp and to gain some awareness of what harpists can do.
Okay. And Mark, in 30 seconds, any quote or aphorism or bit of wisdom on music in terms of your life?
Well, we in our school, we have this project where we ask people to make a false statement that they wish were true as a way of expressing desire. And one of the people who participated in this made the statement, music is social healing, which means she doesn't think it's true yet but thinks it could be.
Should be.
And so I've been pondering that and trying to think of what that would mean, social healing, and how could music do that. So I'm intrigued, and I offer people to do that as well.
Well, let me thank our two guests today, our two composers, Dr. Shirley Meyer-Blankenship and Dr. Mark Enslin. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host for Keeping the Faith, and next week we'll be talking with Sam Banks from the Champaign-Urbana Boys and Girls Club. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fund, to the best of our knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
I'm Donda Beard, Director of Development for Illinois Public Media. During June's WILL TV Fund Drive, we are going to be offering some great special pledge programs, as always. But we're especially excited to offer you the opportunity to make a gift to support your favorite regular weekly shows. So whether it's a local show like Mid-American Gardener or an episode of Masterpiece Mystery, your support will help keep all these great programs on the air. Join us for our June TV Membership Drive from June 1st to June 9th on WILL TV.
Thanks for being with us this last Sunday in May 2013. Up next, This American Life. I'm Jason Croft, and this is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. We're also streaming online at will.illinois.edu. Join us tomorrow at 10 in the morning for our weekday call-in program, Focus. Tomorrow, in honor of Memorial Day, we go to the archives for a show we did in January about the changes in the U.S. military. That's Focus, weekdays at 10.